Good day, everyone. Welcome to the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. To find out more about our upcoming shows or access to our more than 1,800 podcast episodes, visit our website at www.biteradio.me. Today, my special guest is Scott Wiesenthal, author of The Return of the Oyster Catcher, Saving Birds to Save the Planet. In his newest book, The Return of the Oyster Catcher, Scott celebrates the prodigious life-affirming efforts of scientists, conservationists, and indigenous peoples to shelter, heal, and foster bird populations across the globe. Each chapter tells a gripping story about the species, people, and places that have seen results of those endeavors. In one, Scott travels to the shore of Great Slave Lake, the deepest lake in North America, to witness the transition of conservation efforts from a white-led to a native-led coalition, one that recognizes and ratifies a global truth that something like 80% of Earth's remaining biodiversity resides on land controlled or inhabited by indigenous communities. Scott Wiesenthal is an ornithologist and author of nearly 30 books, including the Pulitzer Prize finalist Living on the Wind and the New York Times bestseller A World on the Wing. He is a writer and researcher specializing in birds and bird migration. For more information, you can visit his website, which is www.scottwiesenthal.com, and that's Scott, W-E-I-D-E-N-S-A-U-L.com. And with that, I'd like to welcome Scott to the show. Good day, Scott.
Well, thanks so much, Robert. It's a pleasure to be here.
It is my pleasure. And boy, I learned so much about birds from reading your book that I didn't even know what I didn't know.
Well, that's very flattering. I'm pleased to hear that.
You're welcome. So now, what or even who inspired you to write this book? I understand that your friend and colleague, Charles Duncan, played a role.
Yes, indeed. So a couple of years ago, I wrote a book you mentioned it a moment ago called A World on the Wing about global bird migration. And Charles said, you know, okay, you've done this book about all of the problems facing birds around the world, all the challenges facing migratory birds. He said, why don't you do a book about what's going right for bird conservation? And so that was the inspiration for this. I know a good idea when it's handed to me on a plate.
Absolutely. Now, what's the significance of the title, The Return of the Oyster Catcher?
Well, oyster catchers, I mean, the book deals with dozens of species of birds in dozens of countries around the world. Oyster catchers are just sort of a standard bearer. They're just an example of one species that had been in, you know, steadily declining populations for years and years and years and years. And when conservationists took a hard look at it, figured out, you know, were able to figure out where the threats were, what the problems, what was driving these declines, and they instituted some fairly simple fixes. It turns out that American oyster catchers, they're this big black and white kind of bold, brash shorebird, bright orange legs, bright orange bill. They're found along the Atlantic and Gulf coasts. And they're popular. They nest on beaches, so they're susceptible to beach disturbance. You know, you may have noticed people really like beaches. We spend a lot of time on beaches in the summer. That's great for us, but can be a problem for birds like American oyster catchers and least terns and piping plovers that also nest on beaches. And also, there was a real problem with nest predation. People spend so much time on beaches. We produce a lot of trash near beaches, so there's overflowing trash bins and dumpsters, and that's great for foxes and raccoons and coyotes that are sort of become subsidized predators. And so there's a lot of predation on the beaches. A lot of these oyster catcher nests were being eaten before the chicks even had a chance to hatch. So the scientists working with them realized, you know, if we can increase the productivity of each nest, basically how many chicks each nest produces, by an average of half a chick per nest per year, we could turn what was going to be another 10 or 12% decline over the next decade into about a 30% increase. And so they did some very targeted efforts. They worked with beach communities to reduce beach disturbance. They also trapped and euthanized some of the predators that were out on those beaches at night preying on the nests of these rare birds. Now, they were not whacking every fox or coyote that's on the beach. They were really just targeting the ones that really seemed to be targeting these shorebirds. And it worked. Between 2008, when they started this program, up until recently, the oyster catcher population, which had been dropping 10 or 15% every decade, has gone up about 45%. And there have been equally impressive, in fact, in some cases, even more impressive gains with species like piping plovers, which, you know, for example, in the state of Massachusetts, piping plovers, which do have the benefit of federal protection, they're listed as a threatened species in the Northeast under the U.S. Endangered Species Act. Their population in Massachusetts has drawn up 500%. So just really, you know, terrific success stories there. And that's against the backdrop of shorebirds in general, whose populations, especially those using the Atlantic Flyway, have been declining significantly year after year after year. And in fact, those declines appear to be accelerating. But if scientists take the time to figure out exactly where the problems are and apply some common sense solutions to it, it's possible to turn those declines and turn them into increases.
Wow. Yeah. It is really important, you know, that we approach it in a very methodical way, it seems. Now, you indicate in the very beginning of the book that this is one of optimism. So why does optimism, grounded in evidence, matter in environmental reporting now?
Well, I want to be very clear here that I'm not suggesting that everything is great for birds, because we know that bird populations overall are in decline and have been in decline for a long time. You know, North America has lost about a third of its birds since I was a kid in the 1970s. We have something like 2.9 billion fewer individual birds today than we did in 1970. And there's a host of reasons for that: habitat loss, insecticide use, climate change, windows, cats. I mean, there's a whole host of problems out there for birds. And as I said, I don't want to make it sound like everything's great for them, but I also think that there's a real danger in giving into despair and just kind of throwing up our hands and saying, oh gosh, there's nothing we can do about this. We've brought birds back in the past in really dramatic ways. I graduated from high school in 1976 during the bicentennial year. That year, there were probably fewer than 1,000 bald eagles in the entirety of the lower 48. Peregrine falcons were completely gone. Osprey populations had collapsed. Brown pelican populations were collapsing because of DDT and other pesticides. If you had told me in 1976 that by the time we reached the country's 250th birthday in 2026, that there would be 400,000 bald eagles in the lower 48, I mean, that would have seemed delusional. And yet, that's where we are today. You know, we brought waterfowl back from the brink. You know, particularly since the 1980s, with federal legislation and, you know, transnational agreements with Canada and Mexico to better manage our waterfowl populations, but mostly because we put billions of dollars into restoring and protecting and enhancing wetland habitat. And if you create the habitat, the birds respond, and particularly waterfowl, because they can have these really large clutches of eggs. They can bounce back really, really fast. Now, having said that, we've seen the Supreme Court in recent years strip 95% of America's wetlands of the federal protection under the Clean Water Act. We've seen the current administration kind of marching firmly away from enforcing what had been really key provisions of the Clean Water Act. So we're starting to see some slippage in waterfowl numbers. So the numbers of some ducks are starting to fall. You know, we're going the wrong way. None of this is inevitable. None of this is permanent. You know, we have to keep our eye on the ball. But the point is, if we put our minds to it as a society, we can change things for the better for birds. And if we have a world that works for birds, because there are, you know, there's 11,000 species of birds in the world, and they're found literally over every square mile of both, you know, oceanic and terrestrial habitats on this planet, on, you know, maybe with the exception of right at the South Pole. A world that works for birds is going to work for everything, including us.
Yeah. It is important, and it is very sad to see the slippage, and it seems like we should have learned our lesson, you know, but, you know, I guess it's maybe two steps forward, one step back, you know, kind of situation.
Well, and, you know, and lately it seems like it's multiple steps back. And we've never had an administration that has been as, you know, sort of violently opposed to any kind of environmental protection, any kind of environmental conservation. I mean, we've seen a gutting of federal resource agencies, the Forest Service, the Bureau of Land Management, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the National Park Service. They've all seen huge cuts in budget and huge, you know, many of their most respected and experienced employees were either, you know, sliced out during the Doge attack or have taken early retirement. So, you know, the situation is grim, but mm-hmm. you know, that's all the more reason for us to take inspiration from what we've done in the past and to take inspiration from places across the U.S. and Canada and around the world where people are making a positive difference for birds and for conservation.
Yeah. And I just hope that the resilience and bounce back is as strong as some of the bird populations have been too. Now you have a chapter in your book called, entitled Pain Sufficient Attention. In that chapter, you discuss the North Lookout at Hawk Mountain Sanctuary. You indicated it's a view you knew as intimately as your wife's eyes. So tell us about that. I mean, I just thought that was a wonderful comparison. Can you tell us a little bit about that sanctuary and its significance to you?
Sure. Well, Hawk Mountain is basically the mother church of raptor conservation, the global mother church of raptor conservation. It's a couple thousand acres in eastern Pennsylvania along what's known as the Kittatinny Ridge, which is the front range of the Appalachian Ridge and Valley system. So we're talking a couple of hours northwest of Philadelphia. And it's this, the Ridge and Valley system that goes across Pennsylvania, these long parallel ridges. And in the fall, on windy days, you have this parade of, over the course of the autumn, about 20,000 hawks, eagles, falcons, and vultures that migrate down along this ridge, just kind of basically riding the updrafts of the autumn winds on their way south. Now, these days, as I said, it's a wildlife sanctuary, but in the late 1920s and early 1930s, people gathered up on that ridgetop to shoot these birds as they were going by, because in those days, you know, it was considered the civically responsible thing to do, to shoot birds of prey, because everybody knew the birds of prey were bad. You know, they ate your chickens, they ate the rabbits or the grouse or the pheasant if you were a hunter that you wanted to go out and shoot. And, you know, and it was considered a lot of fun. You know, it's a challenging targets as these birds are flying by. And as word began to leak out in the early 1930s about what was going on up there, there was a fellow from Philadelphia named Richard Poe who went up and took photographs. He and his friends, you know, gathered up hundreds and hundreds of dead hawks from the woods and laid them out in lines and took pictures of them and tried to find somebody that would pay attention to this and do something about this slaughter. And he went to the National Association of Audubon Societies, which is now, you know, the forerunner of today's National Audubon Society. And they weren't thrilled about this, but they didn't really take any action to prevent it. And so he finally went to a woman named Rosalie Edge, who was one of the great, badly underappreciated heroes of North American conservation. And she had a small group called the Emergency Conservation Committee. And when Poe showed her the pictures and she found out that the mountain was up for sale for back taxes, she just bought it. And she did so on the same day that a local gun club was voting to buy the mountain to keep it open for hawk shooting. So that's how close run a thing this was. So they established what was then the world's first sanctuary for birds of prey, the first place in the world where birds of prey were protected. They started doing an annual migration count to you know, track the number of birds that were migrating past the mountain. They've been doing that ever since 1934. It's the longest running migration count in the world. And I got hooked on raptors at Hawk Mountain when I was 12 years old. I went up there for the first time with my family, saw these birds passing by, you know, golden eagles passing by at eye level. It's a deeply important place to me. And I go back every year if I possibly can, even though I now live much farther to the north up in New England. And you climb up to the top of this mountain, to this boulder field, and you watch this astounding parade of migrant raptors, you know, peregrine falcons that are going to southern South America, broad-winged hawks are going to spend the winter in the forests in Bolivia or Peru, red-tailed hawks that will probably just spend the winter in the valley nearby, and bald eagles. I mentioned before, you know, how many bald eagles we have today. And I was up there a couple of years ago with two good friends of mine, and one of whom, my friend Seth, who had been the first intern at Hawk Mountain back in 1977, when he was very much a younger man. And it was a day of mixed emotions because, you know, we saw this parade of like bald eagle after bald eagle after bald eagle after bald eagle. And yet we looked around and the rocks were full of happy people who'd hiked up there and enjoying this lovely fall day, you know, the fall foliage colors, and they were chatting and eating their lunch and occasionally noticing the fact that, you know, the 12th bald eagle of the morning was passing by. And I said to Seth that, you know, I had this feeling like I needed to grab people by the scruff of the neck and shake them and say, look, this, you know, this was not inevitable. You know, we almost lost these. Bald eagles were almost gone. Peregrine falcons were completely gone from the east. You know, none of this was preordained. You know, people worked hard to bring these birds back. And, you know, but at the same time, I really love the fact that we live in a world where people can take bald eagles for granted, because again, that would have seemed incomprehensible to me as a young man, as it did to my friend Seth. So yeah, Hawk Mountain's an amazing place. It's become one of the leaders in global raptor conservation, you know, teaching young biologists from around the world. I've been really privileged to be involved with Hawk Mountain pretty much my entire life. I serve on the board of directors. I've been the chair of the board in the past. It's an amazing place. Anybody who's within driving distance of eastern Pennsylvania during the fall, pick a windy day when there's a northwest wind blowing, go to Hawk Mountain, climb up in the North Lookout, and watch those birds go by.
Yeah, yeah. And I was surprised to learn that the bald eagle wasn't the national bird until the end of 2024, yeah, the end of the Biden administration.
Yeah, I know. Isn't that crazy? I mean, we've just assumed for all these years that at some point in American history, somebody, Congress or whomever, had designated the bald eagle the official national bird, but nobody did. And it took this guy, and I have to confess, I can't remember his name right now, which is kind of embarrassing, who's a bit of a bald eagle obsessive, who tracked down every possible place where it might have happened and finally was able to conclude that no one had ever officially declared the bald eagle the national bird. And so Congress passed a bill, which Joe Biden signed into law just before the end of his administration. So we now finally, officially, after 249 years, had an official national bird after all these years of assuming that we did and we didn't.
Isn't that some? Now, I understand, too, that shortly after that happened, you were driving and saw an eagle fly above and pulled over and watched and indicated that attention needed to be paid.
That's right. Well, exactly. I will confess that, you know, especially living up here in New England, there's a lot of lakes and reservoirs and bogs, and bald eagles are an almost daily sight driving around up here. And I have become complacent myself about bald eagles. And yeah, that day I just heard the news on probably on NPR that Biden had signed this into law and that we officially had an official national bird. And I was driving past, you know, the local lake that separates New Hampshire from Maine, and there was a big old bald eagle going by, pulled over, made sure I paid a little attention to him.
Yeah. Now, I admit that I love bald eagles. Now, I live in Myrtle Beach, so there aren't very many. There are some, but not many. But last Christmas, I went to visit my sister on the coast of Oregon. And there you can drive along certain parts of the beach. And there was one section that bald eagles would often go and roost on the logs, the driftwood there. And so I became obsessive during that week and had to go down there every week, I mean, every day, to see if there was any new bald eagles or, even if there were some.
Yeah, that's the great thing, and they've just become ubiquitous, and good on us for making it possible for them to do that. If we, and we and if we can do it for them, we can do that for a lot of other species.
Yeah, I agree. So now, why are some species rebounding while others continue to decline?
That's a good question, and in some cases we don't really know the answers. I mentioned before about how many individual birds we've lost since the 1970s, and we've seen some really steep declines in groups of birds like warblers and thrushes and tanagers, or what are known as neotropical migrants, these songbirds that migrate from the temperate zone up in the U.S. and Canada down into the Caribbean or Central America, parts of Northern South America. Except there's one group of neotropical migrants, the vireos, red-eyed vireos, blue-headed vireos. There's 8 or 9 different species of them, and they're just going gangbusters. Their populations have risen, and nobody knows why. Their migration paths are similar. Their dietary requirements are similar to some of these other birds. I tend to think of this as the vireo paradox, and I've been asking every ornithologist and conservationist that I meet if they can give me an explanation that makes sense, and nobody has. I don't know why. Now, in other cases, some of the birds that are rebounding are birds that we've made a specific effort for, and I think that's by and large, the birds that are recovering are ones that we've put a lot of effort into. Waterfowl are a really good example of that. Ducks and geese and swans, these are birds that almost disappeared at the in the latter part of the 19th and early 20th century because we were shooting so many of them, mostly for the table. It was the market hunting period where, virtually any bird would wind up, dead and sold in a market. I mean, we, you know, it was, they were killing and selling millions of robins every year. You could walk into a meat market in Baltimore or Chicago or New York and buy robins and Baltimore Orioles and cedar waxwings and flickers and shorebirds of all kinds. These birds were all but wiped out. And then, we shut down the market hunting through legislation, protected birds through the Migratory Bird Treaty Act of 1918. Their numbers started to grow again, and then along comes the Great Depression and the Dust Bowl and those huge droughts. And with waterfowl, drought is the great danger because they need water in order to breed. And the breeding marshes and ponds dried up, and waterfowl populations crashed again. But during the Depression, a lot of land that should never have been plowed was abandoned and was available at fire sale prices, and so the federal government stepped in, started buying up millions of acres of land, funded a lot of those purchases going into the National Wildlife Refuge System. A lot of those purchases funded with a new federal duck stamp for $1 that any waterfowl hunter had to buy. And the duck stamp, as it's known, it's $25 these days. 80% of the money that comes into the duck stamp program still goes into habitat acquisition. And we saw, an enormous expansion of waterfowl numbers starting in the 1980s because we passed legislation through Congress, kind of hard to believe, with bipartisan support, things like the North American Wetlands Conservation Act, or NACA, which set huge amounts of money aside for protecting and enhancing wetland habitat. And we entered into a transnational management agreement with first with Canada called the North American Waterfowl Management Plan, and then later with Mexico, where, you know, these three countries would collaborate on protecting and restoring wetland habitat. And it's, over the course of the years, it's been like $6 billion in both government funds and private match funds. It's worked on about 32 million acres of habitat. Private organizations like Ducks Unlimited have poured millions of dollars of private money into habitat restoration. And the result is that we probably have more waterfowl today than at any point since the beginning of the market hunting period in the late 19th century. Now, again, there's been some slippage. You know, we've seen Supreme Court rulings in recent years that have stripped a lot of federal protection from like 95% of the wetlands in the United States, which is going to be, over time, that's going to be calamitous for ducks. But you know, we know how to bring birds back because we've done it before.
Speaking of the bird recovery, and what does that tell us about climate adaptation?
Oh,
and ecosystem health.
In ecosystem health. So there's some adaptability there. I think what it tells us more about the resiliency of birds, perhaps, than their adaptability. You know, there are limits to what birds can adapt to. They need the habit. They need the habitat. They need is the habitat they need. And there's relatively few birds that can shift from completely from one habitat to another. If you're a grassland bird like a meadowlark or a bobolink, you need grasslands. You can't adapt to living in forests. But we've seen again and again and again that nature in general and birds in particular can be more resilient than we expect them to be. They can bounce back more quickly when conditions are, you know, when we correct the problems that are facing them, when we address the threats that are driving their numbers down. You know, they've lived in very dynamic environments for millions of years, and their ability to shift and take advantage of improving conditions keeps surprising us, even though it probably shouldn't. But it's up to us to make sure that the conditions that they need are there, because, you know, the birds can't do that themselves. In terms of, you know, restoring habitats, for example, and you know, improving the landscape for them, removing the threats that may be, you know, that may be there. And some of those threats should be really simple to correct. You know, if you ask most people, you know, what human-related cause of death for birds is probably the highest. A lot of people will probably tell you wind turbines or cars. And the fact is, the single leading cause of death, you know, more birds are killed by house cats in this country every year than, you know, we're talking 2 to 4 billion with a B, billion birds killed by either free-running house pets or feral cats in this country. It's more than windows. Windows kill about 1 billion birds, more than wind turbines. You know, wind turbines can be dangerous depending on where they're placed, but compared to cats, they're far, far down the list. You know, and yet that's not something most people think about. They, you know, they'll let their cat outside sometimes without giving it a second thought. Even if your cat isn't bringing birds back to the doorstep, pretty much a guarantee if you're letting your cat outside, it's killing birds. And that should be a really simple thing to fix. It's the cat issue for bird conservationists is deeply frustrating, because what often happens is you'll get these what are called managed cat colonies or community cat colonies or trap, neuter, and release colonies, where people are feeding feral cats and basically creating populations of subsidized predators, often at the edges of parks and natural areas where they're just absolutely devastating to local wildlife, not just birds, but mammals, small mammals, reptiles and amphibians. And, you know, that's something that I wish we could address, because, you know, it would probably give us the most bang for the buck in terms of bird conservation. You know, also, if you can figure out ways to, if you've got birds hitting your windows, you know, again, like 1 billion birds a year out of a, you know, continental population of about 20 billion. It's not small change. You know, but there's ways you can treat your windows with little adhesive stickers on the outside that create a gridwork of ultraviolet reflective, basically something that makes the window look solid to the bird. Just strips of tape that you can put on with these little like 1/8 inch square ultraviolet reflective squares that, you know, the birds can see in the ultraviolet range, we can't. So it makes the window look solid to the bird. So instead of thinking that it's that reflective landscape they see as a landscape they can fly into, they realize that they can't, and they veer off. And they're incredibly effective. We have a sliding glass door in our house here in New Hampshire that is the only window that doesn't have screens on the outside. And it was killing a couple of birds a year. We put those dots up, and we have not had a single fatality ever since then.
Yeah. Last week, I was at one of my neighbors, and they too have a sliding glass door, and I happened to notice that they had actually taped up a piece of paper towel, and they said that they were waiting to get the dots that they had ordered to put on the window, because they too have had, you know, a few bird fatalities, you know, crashing in, and they're really heartfelt people, and it just killed them, you know, to see that happen. So anyway, yeah, the idea on a personal level of being able to, you know, get the windows in one's home treated or have a way to be able to put those reflective dots up is just one way that you can contribute to saving some birds.
Yeah, it's not going to save a huge number at any one window, but if we, although depending on the place, there's a building called McCormick Place right on the water in Chicago that had a reputation for years of killing hundreds of birds every year during the migration. And, conservationists in the Chicago area had been pushing for years to do something to this place. And then they had kind of a, you know, terrible, perfect storm of a night a couple of years ago where they had almost 1,000 birds collided with the windows at McCormick Place and were killed. And they, you know, the owners finally had received enough pressure that they treated the windows. And then the next year they had virtually no fatalities. So, you know, it's kind of simple things to do. It's not hard. Turn out your lights at night during spring and fall migration, because artificial night at light kind of draws birds into urban and metropolitan areas where they're more likely to strike into windows. Simple things. The birds, you know, these birds are already flying thousands of miles. You know, these birds that weigh less than half an ounce that are flying, you know, from the boreal forest of Alaska all the way deep into the Amazon River basin for the winter, cut them a little bit of a break. Make life a little bit easier for them on that journey.
Exactly. So you talk about in the book, you have sections about the indigenous-led conservation, and so can you tell us a little bit about how their approach can serve as a model for biodiversity protection?
Absolutely. I think this is probably the single most hopeful story in the whole book. And we're talking here about what's going on primarily in the boreal forest of Canada, which is at 1.5 billion acres, the largest intact forest left on the planet. It's bigger than the Amazon. It's bigger than the Congo, stretching from Alaska all the way to Newfoundland. And it's a bird factory of global significance. There's more than 300 species of birds that breed in the boreal forest of Canada. Warblers, vireos, thrushes, tanagers, whooping cranes, loons, shorebirds, waterfowl. I mean, the list just goes on and on and on. And relatively little of that land has been in any kind of formal conservation protection. There's a few national parks scattered around. And unfortunately, most of the places where those national parks and protected lands have been put in place was to the detriment of the indigenous communities that have lived there for thousands and thousands of years. Because what has happened in the past, the Canadian government would come in, for example, and declare a huge part of the Northwest Territories as Wood Buffalo National Park, and then tell the indigenous communities that have always lived there, okay, well, this is now a national park. So you can't hunt here, you can't fish here, you can't forage or trap here. And if you try, we're going to prosecute you and throw you in jail. And this happened repeatedly through the first half of the 20th century, so that many indigenous communities actively fought against the idea of national parks being declared and designated on their ancestral lands. But what's happened more recently, and I'm speaking here specifically about an area along Great Slave Lake in the Northwest Territories and a community called Lutzel Cay, where since the 1960s, they had been fighting against a Canadian parks effort to try to designate a new national park around the east arm of Great Slave Lake. Because again, they recognized if this happened, their ability to hunt moose and caribou and muskoxen and perhaps even to fish in Great Slave Lake might be compromised. But they recognized by the mid to late 1990s that there was an increasing amount of mineral exploration occurring on their ancestral lands. People from far away, non-Indigenous people coming in and staking mineral claims for diamonds or for base metals. And they realized that they were going to lose control of the land if they didn't have it under some sort of formalized protection. And so they began this very long process, very delicate negotiations with the territorial government in the Northwest Territories, with Parks Canada, to declare about 6.5 million acres of their ancestral land around Great Slave Lake as Thaidene Nene, which translates to land of the ancestors, Thaidene Nene Indigenous Protected Area. And part of that is a Canadian National Park Preserve, part of that is a Territorial Wildlife Preserve, part of that is a Territorial Wilderness Area, but all of it is under the direct management control of the Lutzel Cay Dene First Nation and several other First Nation and Métis communities in that area that use that land for their traditional subsistence lifestyle. And it's sparked a movement across the boreal forest of Canada for more of these Indigenous protected areas, again, under local Indigenous control. That, you know, this, I mean, it seems so logical in hindsight that the people who have lived there for the last 13,000 years would probably know best how to manage that land. And in fact, if you talk to them, I talked to Stephen Nita, who was the Dene chief that negotiated this agreement with the Canadian government. He said, we don't have a management board. We have a relationship board. We manage the human relationship with Thaidene Nene. You know, we listen to what the caribou are telling us they need. We listen to what the land is telling us it needs. So it's a very different approach to, you know, what one might call land management than the traditional Western approach. And they're combining traditional ecological knowledge, traditional Indigenous ecological knowledge, with traditional Western science in a way that I think marries the best aspects of each and makes the research that they're doing there that much more valuable and that much more impactful. And it's happening across the Canadian boreal forest. By the end of this decade, close to 1 billion acres of Canadian boreal forest land will be in some form of formalized or pledged conservation, and almost all of it under the direct control of the Indigenous communities that have always lived there.
Well, that is so encouraging. Leave it to the Canadians to be able to pull it off, you know, and be able to, you know, stage such a massive effort.
Yes. Well, and part of the reason they can do that is because unlike a lot of the Indigenous tribes in the United States, the Indigenous, the First Nations and Métis and Inuit in Canada signed treaties in the early 20th century that gave them rights under Canadian law that are much stronger than is the case with many Native communities in the United States. And also, many of those First Nations communities were never violently dispossessed of their land. They're still living in the places where they had always lived. And so, you know, as opposed to being, you know, shoehorned into tiny little reservations in, you know, often thousands of miles away from their homeland, as we did here in the United States. So it's a different political landscape and legal landscape up there, but one that is generating incredible dividends for conservation and for social justice. I mean, this is it's a win for both. It's a win for conservation, and it's a win for social justice. And I think they're equally important.
Yeah, and it is so encouraging. So I guess the last question I would ask is, what do you hope readers will take away from reading The Return of the Oyster Catcher?
Well, I would hope, you know, a little rekindled sense of optimism and also a better sense of what we can do when we put our minds to it. Because I think one of the biggest challenges we face right now is just despair. You know, there's an increasing feeling, you know, whether it's climate doomerism or whatever, that it's like, oh, you know, there's just nothing we can do. You know, we are totally screwed. You know, why even bother trying? And, you know, the only way any of this is impossible is if we don't try. So let's try. You know, what do we have to lose? You know, if we're going to go down, let's go down fighting. I would hope people would come away with maybe a rekindled sense of possibility, because progress is absolutely possible. We've done it before, and if we put our minds to it, we can do it again.
Yeah, I agree. And your book really does convey that optimism, and that is, it's just so nice in the environment that we're in. We're just constantly bombarded with doom and gloom, you know, kind of the powerlessness of the individual. But your book does a great job of turning the table on that.
Good. I'm glad. Then I've done my job as a writer.
Well, Scott, I really appreciate your time, and thank you for sharing your insight and experience with us today.
Well, it's been a pleasure, Robert. Thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. Again, today, everyone, my special guest has been Scott Wiedenthal, author of The Return of the Oyster Catcher, Saving Birds to Save the Planet. And again, you can find out more by visiting his website, which is www.scottwiedenthal.com. And that's Scott, WEIDENSAUL.com. And I want to thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth Show. And remember to be a bright light by bringing inspiration to your world and to the lives of those you touch.